So today we're going to be looking at Psalm 52, which is on page 573, if you're following in the Church Bible. And David gives us a handy little preamble, which he does with many of his psalms, but this one gives more than just musical direction. It reads, "For the director of music, a maskil of David, when Doeg the Edomite had gone to Saul and told him, David has gone to the house of Ahimelech." So, in order that we might set the scene, I thought we'd first take a look at the events that led up to the writing of Psalm 52 to get a full understanding of where David was coming from when he wrote this. And then in the second half of the talk, we'll look at the psalm itself. So we'll pick up the story in 1 Samuel 20. If you want to turn to it, it's on page 295, but I'll just be skipping through and reading the odd verse here and there. So David was anointed king of Israel by Samuel back in chapter 16. The problem is that Saul, the king of Israel, is still alive. And surprisingly enough, he's not best pleased about the existence of a rival for his son Jonathan's throne. However, Jonathan and David are good friends. More than that, Jonathan accepts that David is God's choice for Israel's next king. That's the symbolism in the encounter in chapter 18, verses 2 to 4. So Saul has organized a festival in chapter 20. And David is meant to be there, but because he's aware of the danger, he doesn't show up. And this is where Jonathan finds out about his father's ill intent towards David. So I'm going to read a couple of verses starting at chapter 20, verse 42. This is after the celebration, and Jonathan's got a rendezvous with David, and he warns him that his father really does want to kill David. Jonathan said, "Go in peace, for we have sworn friendship with each other in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord is witness between you and me, and between your descendants and my descendants forever." Then David left, and Jonathan went back into the town. David went to Nob to Ahimelech the priest. Ahimelech trembled when he met him and asked, "Why are you alone? Why is no one with you?" So the things to remember from that little extract are that David and Jonathan have a covenant of friendship with each other. Now that's originally stated in chapter 18, but they reaffirm it here. And David is on the run from Saul, and he comes to Ahimelech. Remember that little preamble before the psalm? One page, sorry. David has gone to the house of Ahimelech. So David comes to Ahimelech, a priest in the Levitical town of Nob. And Ahimelech provides David with something to eat, which is a story in and of itself. You may remember that Jesus uses that story when speaking to the Pharisees about the purpose of keeping the Sabbath. He also provides David with the sword of Goliath. And between these two little provisions, we have a small detail. In 1 Samuel chapter 21, verse 7, we read, "Now one of Saul's servants was there that day, detained before the Lord. He was Doeg the Edomite, Saul's head shepherd." So the scene is set. The players know their parts and take their places. David leaves Nob and heads to Gath, then on to Adullam, and from there to Mizpah of Moab, and from there to Jerusalem. Meanwhile, Doeg returns to Saul at Gibeah, and we pick up the main thrust of the story in chapter 22, verse 6. How are we doing for time? Yeah, I'll read the whole story to you, verse 6 to verse 23. "Now Saul heard that David and his men had been discovered, and Saul, spear in hand, was seated under the tamarisk tree on the hill at Gibeah, with all his officials standing round him. Saul said to them, 'Listen, men of Benjamin, will the son of Jesse give you all fields and vineyards? Will he make you commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds? Is that why you have all conspired against me? No one tells me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. None of you is concerned about me or tells me that my son has incited my servant to lie in wait for me as he does today. But Doeg the Edomite, who was standing with Saul's officials, said, I saw the son of Jesse come to Ahimelech, son of Ahitub, at Nob. Ahimelech inquired of the Lord for him. He also gave him provisions and the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Then the king sent for the priest Ahimelech, son of Ahitub, and his father's whole family, who were priests at Nob. And they all came to the king. Saul said, Listen now, son of Ahitub. Yes, my lord, he answered. Saul said to him, Why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, giving him bread and a sword and inquiring of God for him, so that he has rebelled against me and lies in wait for me as he does today? Ahimelech answered the king, Who of all your servants is as loyal as David, the king's son-in-law, captain of your bodyguard and highly respected in your household? Was that day the first day I inquired of God for him? Of course not. Let not the king accuse your servant or any of his father's family, for your servant knows nothing at all about this whole affair. But the king said, You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and your father's whole family. Then the king ordered the guards at his side, Turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because they too have sided with David. They knew he was fleeing, yet they did not tell me. But the king's officials were not willing to raise a hand to strike the priests of the Lord. The king then ordered Doeg, You turn and strike down the priests. So Doeg the Edomite turned and struck them down. That day he killed 85 men who wore the linen ephod. He also put to the sword Nob, the town of the priests, with its men, women, its children, infants and cattle, donkeys and sheep. But Abathar, son of Amalekh, son of Ahitub, escaped and fled to join David. He told David that Saul had killed the priests of the Lord. Then David said to Abathar, That day when Doeg the Edomite was there, I knew he would tell Saul, I am responsible for the death of your father's whole family. Stay with me and don't be afraid. The man who is seeking your life is seeking mine also. You'll be safe with me. So Saul starts raging at his servants, asking what can David do for them that he can't. Why are they all siding with David? And at this point, Doeg the Edomite pipes up and offers up just enough information to cause trouble. Just enough truth to paint Ahimelech the priest as an enemy of the state. And now the priests of Nob are called to a farce of a trial. And though they swear they knew nothing of David's so-called rebellion, Saul ignores their testimony and sentences them to death. But Saul's men refuse to lay a hand on God's priests. So Saul has Doeg carry out the sentence, and he, being far too eager to please, kills not only the priests, but raises the town of Nob. But one man escapes and brings news to David, who is wrought with guilt. And out of this place of sorrow and anger, he writes Psalm 52. Why do you boast of evil, you mighty man? Why do you boast all day long, you who are a disgrace in the eyes of God? Your tongue plots destruction. It is like a sharpened razor, you who practice deceit. You love evil rather than good, falsehood rather than speaking the truth. You love every harmful word, O you deceitful tongue. Surely God will bring you down to everlasting ruin. He will snatch you up and tear you from your tent. He will uproot you from the land of the living. The righteous shall see and fear. They will laugh at him, saying, Here now is the man who did not make God his stronghold, but trusted in his great wealth and grew strong by destroying others. But I am like an olive tree, flourishing in the house of God. I trust in God's unfailing love forever and ever. I will praise you forever for what you have done. In your name I will hope, for your name is good. I will praise you in the presence of your saints. So David helpfully gave us context in his preamble, and he also tells us exactly what we're to remember in this psalm by use of a fairly common Hebrew literary structure called a chiasm or a chiastic structure. Now this name comes from the Greek letter chi, which as a capital is the same as a capital X. And the structure gives us two tools to analyse the meaning of the psalm. The first is that it's symmetrical, like a letter X. The first half of the psalm reflects the second half and vice versa, and their differences give rise to a meaning. And the second tool is that the moral of the story comes in the middle. X marks the spot, if you like. So if we think first of the two halves of the psalm, I think it raises two questions. Firstly, the psalm seems to ask, where do your securities lie? And secondly, what does your tongue say about you? And then the central emphasis of the psalm is that God will act. In this case, we have an act of judgment in verse 5, which is measured and appropriate. And we'll look at that in more detail in a few minutes. So firstly, the psalm asks, where does your security lie? If we look at verse 1, why do you boast of evil? He's boasting in his security, which is acts of evil. Or if we look at verse 7, David says that Doeg's refuge is not God. It is rather his great wealth, and his destroying of others. So David's talking about Doeg here, referring to the way that he manipulated circumstances to attain a stronger position. Do you remember when we first met him in 1 Samuel 21? Do you remember what his job title was? Verse 7 of 1 Samuel 21 says that he was a head shepherd. Not exactly the most glamorous role. Sure, he was head shepherd for the king of Israel, but he was still just a glorified shepherd. And yet at the end of 1 Samuel 22, we found him as an executioner and an inquisitor, probably a commander, unless he managed to raise an entire city by himself. And how did he get from menial servant to mighty man? He manipulated and maneuvered and stirred the pot for a king that he knew to be unstable with a few half-truths about a priest and some bread and a sword. Do you think Saul would have responded the same way had Doeg not mentioned the sword of Goliath? Or had he included the detail that Ahimelech had trembled before David, presumably because Ahimelech thought that David was there on the king's business? David started life as a shepherd as well, but he was humble and he was capable, and God elevated his position. Doeg, on the other hand, glorifies himself. We seem to be moving naturally toward the second question. What does your tongue say about you? In Hebrew literature, body parts are significant. Where we would metaphorically use the word heart, in the Hebrew we would find the word liver or kidney, depending exactly which emotion we were trying to convey. But tongue to the Hebrew reader would be a primary indicator of someone's character. What does David tell us about Doeg's tongue? In the psalm, verses 2 to 4. That's not the same version as you are reading, sorry. Your tongue plots destruction. It is like a sharpened razor, you who practice deceit. You love evil rather than good, falsehood rather than speaking the truth. You love every harmful word, O you deceitful tongue. He tells us that Doeg was deceptive and destructive because that's what the words of his mouth did. They deceived and they destroyed. And here we come to the center of the psalm, verse 5. It's David's take-home point. And it serves two purposes. Firstly, it is judgment on Doeg. And secondly, it's a warning for us. And then in the rest of the psalm, David talks about what it's like to live a life that's not like Doeg's. So, verse 5. Again, I wrote it out in a different version. Surely God will bring you down to everlasting ruin. He will snatch you up and tear you from your tent, and he will uproot you from the land of the living. Remember, I said that this judgment was measured and appropriate, and when we first read it, it seems a little harsh. But the New Bible Commentary breaks the statement down into three distinct areas of life. Firstly, he says that God will bring you down to ruin. You. As this personal sphere of life. Secondly, he says that he will snatch you up and tear you from your tent, which is the domestic sphere of life. And thirdly, he said he will uproot you from the land of the living, which is an earthly sphere. So we've got a personal, a domestic, and an earthly area of life. Notice also that tent and land would have connotations of security. And remember that Doeg's security lies in himself and his lies and his works of destruction. So look at the language used here. God is tearing away Doeg's false security. Do you remember what Doeg did to Ahimelech? Doeg not only killed him, a personal act of sin, but killed his family, the 85 persons who wore the linen ephod, a domestic attack. And thirdly, he razed the city. He seemed to kill everything that had breath in the town of Nob, an earthly attack. So David's judgment, and if we're assuming, which I think we should, that David is writing through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, then this is God's judgment as well, is proportionate to the offense. And the judgment for Doeg is a warning for others. If we read in verse 6, the righteous will see and fear. You'd be glad to know the tone starts to lift here. Sorry, it's been a little bit heavy so far. We looked at security and we looked at tongues. So now we're going to look at those again in faithfulness to the chiastic style. However, this time we're going to see what that means for a righteous person, someone who is right with God. We're going to see what use we should have for our tongues and where our securities should lie if we learn the lesson that David teaches in verse 5. We learn the lesson from the judgment of Doeg. The first thing we notice, which might seem a little odd to our ears, is that they laugh at Doeg. Now, it's key here that we don't mistake this for a vindictive laughter aimed at Doeg himself. This laughter is a laugh of joy, of praise for God's intervention. It is not a laugh at the misfortune of another, but it is an expression of gladness that we have a God who cares about justice and who will act. When we look around at the world and we see pain and injustice and suffering, and something inside us just screams, no, that is not the way it should be. Is it not good to know that God put that there because that is how he feels? And that guilty little spark of joy we get when you see the guilty punished, we have to be careful with that. So long as that joy is not vindictive and we're not rejoicing in the suffering of another, but we are in fact rejoicing in justice being done, then we are laughing with the same purity as those in verse 6. And look at how that laughter snowballs for the rest of the psalm into an expression of joy and praise in verses 8 and 9. But I am like an olive tree flourishing in the house of God. I trust in God's unfailing love forever and ever. I will praise you forever for what you have done. In your name I will hope, for your name is good. I will praise you in the presence of your saints. So we have this tongue of praise if we learn the lesson that David is trying to teach here. But where does David's security lie? Did you spot that? I will trust in God's unfailing love forever and ever. And also contrast the images used. Remember the image of being uprooted in verse 5. And now we have a tree that is flourishing in the house of God. And can only flourish if it is well rooted. So are we tempted to put our securities in things other than God? I realized this on the way in this morning. I was nervous about getting the train, just in case it was late, because you never know. I was nervous about the card machine not working when I tried to buy my ticket. So I took a route that went past 3 or 4 different cash machines, just in case. And where is the trust in God and all of that? And they're simple, trivial examples, but I'm sure every day we put measures in place that we can argue are sensible, but are we trusting in things other than God? So the person that is considered right before God is someone who finds their security in him and who can't help but praise him. But the really great news from this passage is in verse 5, even though it seems so harsh. You see, all of us have lied or been selective with the truth, and all of us have, at one time or another, put our security in something other than God, our Father. The good news is that God demands that justice is done. He's not just going to let that slide. But the great news of the Christian message is that God himself was broken down. And we read in 1 John 1 that he pitched his tent among us. But he was ripped from it. And he was removed from the land of the living as punishments for our missteps. But the grave could not hold Jesus Christ. And after 3 days, he rose again so that we can have life in him.